Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
So, hey, everybody, welcome to episode 331 of the More Than Just Go podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell, and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
More Than Just Code is produced in Toronto, and we also acknowledge that the land we're situated on is part of the greater Toronto area land of the Mississaugas of the Credit, Anishinaabe, Chippewa, Haudenosaunee, and the Huron-Wendat peoples. Alrighty. So we'll just start off with some fact check here. I mentioned, I don't know what I said on the show, but I was talking about a gentleman who I follow on the YouTube. His name is Marquise Brown, or Marcus Brown, I guess. But it's he goes by MKBHD, which is a little, well, doesn't roll off the tongue quite so well. So I mentioned him last week as being one of the people he was the one who was doing the unboxing stuff from the last event that Apple had before the iPad Pro M1 event and the iMac M1 event. And the other thing we were talking, special guests, Evan and Leo were on last weekend, or last time we had a show, and we couldn't remember what the third thing was that they introduced at the Apple event. And that, of course, was AirTags. So, duh. And I bought, four of them, and I've been using my 3D printer to print little holders for them and all that kind of stuff. So we put one in the car because we park on the street here, right? And it's kind of handy. Like, we kind of generally, tell each other where the car is. We only have one car between the two of us, right? And so we put an AirTag in the car so we would be able to find out where we parked the car. That's kind of handy, right? And I've got visual. Oh, yes, right. And the app we were talking about that generates iOS app that generates QR codes, if you're interested, it's called Visual Codes app. And that was, I met the developer at WWDC 2019, and I've been using it ever since then to create barcodes for things like the podcast. Like, I think, Mark, you were talking about like a business card kind of deal where you could scan a QR code and pass on your information to somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And we were also talking about Better Call Saul, I think, in the after show, right? Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. And Tiny, I think his name is, the bodyguard for our pal Saul Goodman, was played by Lavelle Crawford, and the character is Huel Babineau is the name of the character on the show, but I think he goes by Tiny, right? So as a follow-up, yesterday, June 29th, 2021, and today's the 30th as we record, but on the 29th was the 14th anniversary of the for sale date of the original OG iPhone. And they covered it on Mac Break with Rene Ritchie and Leo Laporte and Andy Anako. And they covered, they talked about the iPhone, and they walked through, I'd like to get, I'd have to get a link for the show notes. They walked through the 9 to 5 apparently had a retrospective with pictures and videos and stuff like that of the event of, you know, because they were talking, I don't know if you remember this, but you had to go stand in line at the Apple store or the AT&T store to get an iPhone back in the day, like in those first iPhones. There was only a limited amount of them at each store, and you couldn't order them online and that kind of stuff, right? So
that lasted for a few years. It wasn't just right at the beginning.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Every year that they came out with a new phone, it was an event, right?
Yep.
Yeah. When did you get your first iPhone, Mark?
The 3G was my first iPhone.
Really? Oh, wow. You didn't have the 2G or the Edge one.
No, it was
the Silverback Gorilla one.
I believe it was.
It was originally 8 gig.
Maybe it was
4 gig or 8 gig.
Yeah,
came in a big giant box.
That was the second version, though, right? The first.
Yeah, 3G was the second version.
Yeah, that's what I had the second version. I didn't have the first version.
Yeah, but that's why I was surprised. I mean, 3G was the first one that was officially available in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what about you, Jaime? What was your first phone?
Pretty late in the game compared to you all. That was the iPhone 4S in 2011.
4S, wow, that's even after Steve Jobs had the big kerfuffle at keynote, which I was there for actually, which was kind of fun. But I was playing hockey at the time, and one of the guys I knew was into this stuff because he worked for Rogers, and he went down to San Francisco and said, "Hey, do you want an iPhone?" I'm like, "Yes." So he brought me back an iPhone from San Francisco that he picked up at AT&T, and I think I paid like $500. For it or something like that. And it's funny because I took it out today after watching the thing, and I've got a 3GS here, and I've replaced the battery in it already at least once, and it won't charge anymore because the battery's spent in it, right? But I pulled up my original Silverback, 8 gigabyte phone, and which, by the way, we had to unlock them to use them in Canada because we couldn't even we didn't have enough service for it. I think you had to do that with the States too, right? If you didn't want to use AT&T, but it charges and runs and all that kind of stuff, so I can actually launch the app or launch the phone and use apps and stuff like that. Unfortunately for me, the home button was destroyed by my grandchildren playing with it in the back seat of the car. So I launch an app, and then I have to shut the phone down to quit the app. So it's kind of a drag. But yeah, lots of fun. Good thing the app doesn't persist between launches, right? So that would suck. Anyway, so that's the name of that tune. And I did put it here. Yeah. So the other thing they talked about on the show, which is a bit kind of more, I think, widespreading, other than the fact that we're all here because of the iPhone, is the 20th anniversary of WebKit was also yesterday. And WebKit was, the Apple's first attempt at building their own browser. You know, Don Melt was hired by Scott Forstall to create a browser for the Mac, right? And I think at the time, I want to say Gecko was the sort of go-to one, but it was larger than... Apparently the one they looked at was larger than the actual code base was larger than all of Mac OS at the time. Mac OS 10, I guess they called it back then. Mac OS 10. And so he took the Conqueror, KDE, KHTML browser and ported it over to this and created an open source project called WebKit. And WebKit is now in just about everything, right? It's obviously a big part of our world, iOS and Mac, but apparently BlackBerry used a port of it. I think Chromium had a port of it for a while. So just about every mobile device. In fact, Apple, I think they make people use WebKit. I heard them say that on the show today, that even like the Chrome browser on iOS is also using WebKit under the hood. So kind of interesting thing. What do you guys have any comments about WebKit or history of?
Not really. I'm kind of surprised it's that old. I'm surprised it predated the iPhone by that much. You know, my memory is getting kind of foggy of those days, I guess.
Well, we used to, if you remember, the very first Mac OS 10 had Explorer was the browser, right? And I think, if I remember correctly, Office X was the first, or Office 10, I guess, was the first official set of apps that I had that were native on the old beta, right? Mm-hmm. So I think Apple had a deal it sort of rode off that sort of, controversial Bill Gates, Microsoft investing in Apple in their low point, right? When Jobs came back, just before the iMac. So yeah, I think the Explorer browser was a big part of of those days, right? Yep. I'm trying to remember when the Bondi Blue Mac iMac came out. It didn't have Safari. Safari's was 20 years ago. Was that work out to 90?
That was like 98, 99 when the Blue iMac came out, wasn't it?
I want to say I remember I was in Vancouver in 96, 97. So that's when Jobs came back. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think you're right. It was around 98 maybe that the iMac. We'll have to look it up, but I think 98 around that time. Yeah, I think you're right. Around that time was when the Bondi Blue Mac first came out, right? Mm-hmm. And then the Rainbow Macs came after that. But I don't recall if Safari was... Where was Safari then? Let's have a quick gander at the old Wikipedia here.
While you're looking at that up, we just had an earthquake.
You had an earthquake just now?
Just now, yep.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yep. Little one, not a big deal.
Yeah.
I'm looking online now to see if there's any record of it to find out how big it was, but they're not even talking about it, so it's too small to even worry about.
Okay, so the PowerPC-based iMac, what came out August 15th, 1998, 22 years ago, that had a G3 processor in it, right? And let's see, when did Safari come out? Well, Safari obviously came out 20 years ago, which is, that worked out to 2001, right? Yeah. 2021 minus 20 is 2001. Thanks for helping, guys.
I went off on a little tangent to look up because you mentioned the Chrome browser thing.
Chromium
did use WebKit early on, but it looks like back in 2013, 2014 is when they split off from that. They forked and created Blink, which is the browser engine behind Chromium-based browsers, and include Chrome and Microsoft Edge and Opera, apparently.
Opera, yes, right. Is Opera no longer using WebKit?
According to this comparison of browser engines page on Wikipedia.
Cool. All right. And so Safari, just for science, came out in 2003, and that was in Panther first operating system it appeared in. Oh yeah, cool. It's built in WebKit and Nitro, whatever Nitro is. So there you go. That's the history of and the fact checky thing. Oh, we have one more thing in fact check though, and that is, and I just put this here under fact check because we always talk about these kind of things in this area. iPhone 12 apparently has hit 100 million, estimated 100 million devices sold, and it's sort of having a iPhone 6 moment is what the article says here in terms of sales. It's quite a bit, eh? What do you think? Supercycle, they're calling it.
It's kind of interesting that this happened during the pandemic. I wonder if you'd almost think that people would be less likely to go buying phones when they were stuck at home because they're not really out and about. But on the other hand, for a lot of people, the phone is like their main way of communicating with people. So if they can't see people in person, they're on the phone more, so maybe they want the latest and greatest phone. So maybe that drove up demand.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think it's been, what, 5-ish years since the iPhone 6 came out? Mm-hmm. So if people were holding on to devices for longer, and to your point, Mark, got to a pandemic and said, you know what, this thing is old and junky. I'll just go ahead and buy a new iPhone this year. Especially because all that money that was saved on not going out, you know, no restaurant bills.
Yep.
No hanging out with your buddies, drinking beers.
Yeah, not commuting. Yeah. All that disposable income, I guess.
The stimmy maybe had an impact on that.
Mm-hmm. The which?
The stimulus in the U.S. Can't speak around the world.
Oh.
But this report here says that the United States contributed to 40% of the global iPhone 12 Pro Max sales through April.
Wow.
Which is considerable for one country in the modern era to contribute for just, you know, that high of a percentage.
Yeah, you guys buy a lot of stuff down there in the States. But, you know, it's funny because I wonder, like, obviously, I'm sure the Android devices still eclipse us, you know, in Asia and Europe, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's still like 15-20% of the market for the iPhone globally.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, it talks about 5G and OLED being sort of, I guess, another feature of these devices that makes them attractive. Yeah, because the 6 was the first significant form factor, it says here, and pent-up demand for large phones. Yeah, we all went out and, I mean, two out of three of us bought, you know, the plus size 6 when it came out, right? And two out of four, I should say. Yeah, we were all
Let's see, what year would that have been? So this is 2000.
Four Musketeers.
This is 2021 now, right? So the 12 came out in 2020. Was there an 11S? Backward math. Was there an 11S? I don't remember anymore.
No, there was 11.
Okay, so that would have been 11. Would have been 2019. 10. The 10S was 18, right?
What's there, 10S?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
10S, yeah, there was a 10S and a 10C and 10R, right? 10S, 10R, 10C. Right.
And then a 10.
Then the 10. And then the 8.
A 10 would have been three and a bit years ago because my warranty just ran out, right?
Well, okay. Now you messed us up. Okay. 2020 was the 11.
There's this site called Wikipedia, which lists all this stuff.
Yeah, all right. Fine.
No, you can do your background.
I've looked it up, and I'm kind of curious if you'll get the right date.
Yeah, okay. Let's see.
Right, let's do it then.
Can Mark do it?
2020 was the 11. 2019 was the the XS, right? 2018 mm-hmm. was the, no, that can't be right. 2018 wasn't the 10. That was too late. The 10 was 2000, was earlier than that.
I'll give a hint. That was the weird year that both the 8 and the 10 came out in the same year. There is no 9.
Yeah, there was no 9, right? There was the 8 and the 10, but well, I'm confused now. So, okay, 2020 was the 11. No, 2020 was the 12. That's right. That's where we're off. Because this is 2021. 2020 was the 12. 2019 was the 11. 2018 was the XS. Right. 2017 would have been the 8 and the 10. So 2016 would have been the 7S. Then 2015 would be the 7. 2014 would be the 6S. And then 2013 would be the 6.
Hmm. You're close. You're close.
So close.
Really?
So close. So I see the pattern you were going with.
You're Apple off by one.
Through some curveballs. So there is no 7S model.
Oh, there's no 7S. Oh.
So everything shifts by 1 year.
Got it. Okay. It
was so this podcast started in August of 2014. Mm. We're coming up on our anniversary, by the way. Mm. Yeah. So we started in 2014. So,
by the way, are you guys going to Denver this summer?
I have an online ticket.
Online ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think we're ready to start flying here in Canada. We just came out of, I think we just went to plan two or whatever they call it, phase two mm-hmm. of reopening. Mm-hmm. We're ahead of the game in terms of the required number of people with a single vaccine and double vaccine. I think 30% of us have two vaccines and about 75 or 80% of us have had a first shot.
Yeah. So here in the Bay Area, we're over 80% vaccinated. So we're 100% open now completely. I mean, there's no
100%
open. Yeah. But however, there's fear of this new Delta variant. They're talking about, talking about maybe starting to, well, the first thing they're talking about is just requiring masks indoors again.
Oh, you're maskless as well.
Yeah. Oh, where it's
living on the edge.
We are. Yeah. I mean, as far as the law is concerned, we are pre-pandemic right now. Now, here in the Bay Area, people still wear masks a lot, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think elsewhere, they probably don't at all.
Yeah, we have our, you know, different theories about it. I mean, a lot of people outside don't wear it. I still wear mine, even though I'm double vaxxed. And I feel odd going outside without it.
Yeah, it's weird.
But yeah,
it's weird.
But the Delta variant, like, I've seen some things, and I don't want to promote things that I've seen on Facebook or heard on the news or whatever, but I have heard that you just have to be in the same room with someone who has a Delta variant to catch it. Like, don't have to make contact or anything like that, right? So, and it's pretty virulent. I've heard that if one person in a family brings home the Delta, then everybody in the family gets it.
The being in the same room part, or the no contact part, was true about the virus in general, right? It was never a contact thing. It was always a breathing thing. But yeah, but they are saying the Delta is way more infectious and dangerous than the previous one. But they're still saying, though, that the current vaccines still work fine for it. So if you're vaccinated, at least as of today, you're okay. But if you're not vaccinated, you could be in big trouble.
But being vaccinated is like a seatbelt in a car. You could still, you know, get seriously hurt, you know?
True.
It keeps you out of the hospital and keeps you from just plain dying. But,
right.
You know,
right.
But it is carte blanche.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So are we done with the iPhone?
So 2014 for that iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Mm-hmm. So 6 years ago. I'm off by 1 year. I thought it was around 5.
You
so,
were?
Yeah, I think it totally makes sense for there to be a super cycle here. Good quality devices and people having a reason and some opportunity to upgrade. I could buy this report.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's all, I think it's speculative too, because, you know, Apple doesn't release their numbers, right?
So not by model. No, they don't do that.
Alrighty. Okay. Let's move on to wrapping completion handlers with Async API, which is a link that I found here from John Sundell, I believe. Is John by, yeah,
he didn't actually write it, but it's by his. It's
yeah, his WWC by Sundell and Friends. Yeah, this is written by, I got the name of the guy. It is, Vincent. I'm going to go with Pralis. Anyway, that's the name I'm going to attempt to say. Yeah, this is interesting. It talks about some of the new things that are happening with, like, I guess that completion handlers is how we used to have to trail off, you know, these kind of calls before. But now there's some new shiny ways of doing stuff, like the old URL session data with data task. You know, you had to pass in a URL request and you would get out a data or URL response and an error and returning void, whatever. But now it's just, you know, a much more clean way of, or a quicker way of writing it out without, instead of having a completion handler, you're actually returning a data type of data and URL resource. So, and it obviously can throw because you can't have an error, but. So anyway, I don't know if you guys have read this article, probably can explain it better than me, but that's the gist I got from it, that it's a much more succinct way of writing.
Right. So async await is the new hotness that was introduced at WWDC. So this article was specifically about how do you convert your existing methods that may take a completion handler. So not using the Apple APIs, but it's your methods that you've written that take a completion handler. How do you convert that into async await without having to rewrite all your code? And so Apple has provided a pretty nice method that just makes that almost trivial. It's this method called with checked continuation. And basically you just, so with checked continuation is a marked async function. So you can just, you can await that. And this thing takes a closure where you put your old method that returns, that uses a completion handler. And when that completion handler returns, a little bit funky, then you call this continuation resume, and it will just pick up where the function left and return the result back. Or, and there's ways to make it throw as well. So it's kind of a cool thing. The gist of this article is not so much about async await itself, but how do you make your old existing
convert your stuff
functions work with async await.
Yeah, I somehow missed the only mentioned a couple of times in here the with check continuation function.
Cool. Yeah, I mean the key part of it is way towards the bottom, right above the conclusion, where you can see how nice the calling site looks. And that's the nice thing of going through all this effort.
Right. Cool. All right. And then Jaime, you got some stuff. I posted this in here in case you hadn't. For some reason, I thought you hadn't posted it in here, but you have. I'll let you rip into it.
Yeah, so GitHub came out with its GitHub Copilot. What it says here on the tin is your AI pair programmer. And this seems pretty neat. It's apparently powered by OpenAI, and it is kind of like that that next step we need towards the Star Trek, the Next Generation style of computing. Right. It's like, computer, I need a table. No, I need it to be 4 feet high and 5 feet wide and make it out of wood instead of steel. This is getting scarily close to that, where you have this thing that is running some machine learning algorithms on what you're writing there. So you write just a little bit of, here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do sentiment analysis or parse expenses or how many days are there between dates. And it has already been trained on this large volume of code that's out there, presumably a lot of it open source through, hosted on GitHub itself. And it just sort of fills in like autocomplete on super steroids. That's sort of how I think of it here. It's like, oh, you want to convert comments into code? Yeah, it can do that. Oh, you don't want to do repetitive stuff like making all of these different dictionaries? Yeah, we can fill those out too. It's pretty impressive to me.
It looks pretty magical. I wonder how well it works in real life. I don't know. I wonder.
And is it gonna plug into like Visual Code Editor and things like Xcode and stuff like that?
So it's starting out. So right now it's actually in technical preview. So not everybody can use this as of this very recording. Right now they're focusing on Visual Studio Code, but I don't really see reasons why they couldn't make it available elsewhere. And will there be a paid version in the plus lifestyle that we all live nowadays? If the technical preview is successful, our plan is to build a commercial version in the future. So they want to use the preview of Copilot to figure out how people use it. So, I mean, it sort of makes sense that you would have those different options. I think that it's one of those things that makes GitHub stickier. So given that Microsoft is all about, Azure services and getting their stuff everywhere, I would not be surprised to see this available elsewhere, but probably going to get the best experience if you're into that ecosystem.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Somebody at work described it as Stack Overflow in your IDE, right there in your IDE.
Yeah. And I've seen some fair criticisms coming around, like, this isn't writing the code isn't the hardest part. And that's true. But I also like my autocomplete. I would never, ever go back to a world where we didn't have autocomplete, right? Yeah. I mean, autocomplete is making some educated guesses as to what it thinks you're trying to put out, which is why we always, appreciated back in the day whenever it was that Xcode no longer gave you, NS stream. No, because nobody ever used those compared to the huge volume of, there were dozens of us who did, I guess, but then compared to the overwhelming, millions of people who wanted NS string, think of this, you know, like being its bigger brother. That's how I think of it. Like I wouldn't just close my eyes, write a few comments and then say, oh, my app is ready. Well, no, this isn't that. This is, you know, spare me the boilerplate, spare me the having to think about like, oh yeah, that's right. I need to initialize this thing. Totally forgot about that.
What I think it's kind of like is an automated version of in Xcode where they have the code snippets that you can use. Just like, I think probably most people don't actually use this, and I don't remember having used it more than once or twice, but in the same way that you can in Interface Builder, you can grab items and drop it in. But there's also a thing where there's a whole bunch of like boilerplate code that Xcode will just provide to you that you can just drop in. Did you even know this was there?
That's true. Yeah.
You guys know?
The snippets? Yeah. But I don't think I've paid attention to how much power is there. I usually have made my own snippets.
And you can make your own too, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's not a huge amount there of power, right? But this is kind of doing that, what you have to do there manually and with a limited set of choices. This is automating for you. So if it actually works, it's actually pretty cool. You know, if you could have it just go off and find these random snippets of code for anything you want to do, it's pretty cool. It could be a real time saver. It also runs the risk of people having a lot of code that they don't know how it works that just they throw in into their code base, which
that's the Stack Overflow
happens
reference,
a lot.
Yeah.
But it could be cool. With great power comes great responsibility, I suppose.
Yeah. So right. I kind of wonder, like, you know, based on the fact that it says here in the article, I read it somewhere that it builds on, you know, the vast, you know, amounts of open code that's on GitHub. And I kind of wonder, will it democratize or will it, you know, sanitize or what's the word I'm looking at, homogenize the code that's out there? Because it's basically looking at the best code of a lot of different people.
Well,
right?
Or who says it's the best code, right? It's curve.
That's what I mean.
If there's way more crappy code out there than good code and it's curve fitting to the crap to the whole set, then you're going to get something that's skewed towards the crappy code than the good code, for sure.
Well, here's an example, like, and this comes from my print and publishing experience, and that is the standard, you know, color balance or color gamut that people worked towards in Photoshops and stuff like that back in the day was swap, S-W-O-P. And what that was, and it was sort of like a standard that everybody would kind of target as, you know, the standard, you know, standard web offset press is what it stood for. But the reality was they went around and edited all the crappy offset printers in the United States and came up with this, you know, lowest common denominator. That's what I mean about, like, are we going to end up with the lowest common denominator of code out there? If I mean, not that everybody's going to rely on this thing, but that's potentially, I'm building on Jaime's crass comment in our Slack channel that this is kind of like Skynet coding, right?
Skynet doesn't like the data structure you've chosen or whatever it was I said. Let's use a hash table instead of a linked list. Yeah,
for sure. Lots of fun. Well, speaking of hash tables, so we were talking at work, and one of the guys did a demo on Mark's favorite thing from 2019, which is Diffable Data Source.
Yeah,
and I keep meaning to go and watch that video, but anyway, he had this demo the other day, and it's very cool that it's kind of like it's similar to how Swift UI is doing stuff with lists and stuff like that. Whereas you want to have a reference to something, you don't use index path anymore, right? You use you assign a UID UUID, and then you can update a table, for example, or a collection view just inside the cell without having to reload the entire table, right? Is that the gist of it, Mark?
What, a Diffable data source?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a...
That's a small piece of it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just that alone is pretty cool, right?
Yeah. I mean, the basic idea is that the data source itself keeps track of the state.
Right.
And you use this concept of a snapshot that has a different state from your previous state, however you want to make it, and then you just tell the data source to apply the state to your collection view or table view,
right?
And it goes and figures out how it has to change all the cells and everything. So none of this. Remember, there was this batch updates or begin updates if it was
perform batches.
You'd inevitably get it wrong at some point, get the count wrong, and the app would crash at some point while you're developing it. All that's gone because you just have to, since it knows the previous state, you just have to give it a new state and it will automatically do the diff for you, hence the Diffable data source. It will do the diff and figure out all of the updates that it needs to do to make your collection view suddenly use the new data set from the old data set.
Right. So like if it has to update or modify or delete a cell, it knows or content, it knows what to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
Yep. All right.
Cool
stuff. In line with the GitHub Copilot thing, I view Diffable data source as So somebody came up with the algorithm behind that back in like the 70s. And if you remember, longtime listeners to the show remember the IG list kit. So the Instagram folks said, hey, we've got this problem. We want to make, you know, this thing really performant and reduce crashes and et cetera. And they also discovered this, like, you know, dissertation or thesis or something from like the 1970s or something. Say, hey, here's the algorithm you should use. And they implemented it. So good for them. The whole Davisaurus is that in the Apple ecosystem. Like, never again shall anybody have to figure out how to do this. Because it's a solved problem, so just adhere to this thing. And I think it's pretty nice because we can move up, a, you know, in the stack of like, okay, now what do we need to worry about? We need to worry about how to put badges on these little icons here. The hard problems.
Well, that's coming. That's coming.
Exactly.
I think it's coming in your next. Was that your clever segue, Jaime?
I don't know if it's clever. I wouldn't make that claim, but it was a segue into
all right.
This next article from 5stars.blog about what's new in SwiftUI. It's not necessarily comprehensive, but it shows some of the interesting things. And there's certainly nice things. I think we've talked about in the previous episode about the new button styles. So getting a chance to see what that looks like is kind of cool. The interface orientation for SwiftUI previews is great. Just continuing that whole idea of like, look, just show me every possible combination I might have for this item so I can see while I'm typing it up and coding it, what it looks like. And I noticed the badges thing, but I thought, oh, that's so great because everybody wants to add badges to their, you know, their tab bars or their lists and et cetera. And I don't know that, you know, the next new hotness will be based off of this, but at least from a basic utility, I mean, just dot badge, the number one. Great. You've got a badge with one.
Yeah.
And it apparently, which gave me the oohs and ahs, like, oh, it even works on lists too, and it'll do the right thing in a list. So that's pretty neat. I like that stuff. Good quality of life sort of thing for developers.
Yeah, new toggles coming as well. Easier ways to call colors out. Different ways to style buttons. Yeah,
this fits in the same category of what we're talking about the, you know, the data format. The date formatters are now gone, right? They've been replaced by just a method on date, which is, you know, just a quality of life improvement for developers, as you said.
Yeah, and like dismissing views and stuff like that is now a simple, you know, almost like an enum value, right, under our environment. It was this the article that talked about, maybe it was the one previous to that, where we had the new property wrapper. Like last WWDC, we got the new property wrappers, like the app state, what was that called? This is in dark mode now, so it doesn't look familiar to me. The property wrappers with optional raw representable, right? Representable. We had the app storage and the scene storage stuff that was added last year, and now we have this raw representable thing. Can you guys explain that? So it's like near the bottom of the article.
Yeah, the way I understand it is that you can have an option. So property wrappers have an optional, can be associated with an optional raw representable type, which would make it that you can have like an enum that doesn't have a default value. It says here, in this example, the picker will have no value selected at launch. So the picker has a picker from an enum of cases of banana, orange, mango, and you don't have to have any default. We're thinking of like, okay, and default equals one or default equals banana, similar type things.
Okay, yeah, I think I follow you. All right, move on.
One of those quality of life ones, also from the WWDC by Sundell and Friends, this time actually written by John Sundell, SwiftUI's async image or rendering remote images from URLs, which is one of those things that you will very commonly see people get third-party software for, right? In the old Objective-C days, it would have been SD Web Image. Swift has a few different options like Kingfisher. Now you can just go rip those right out, assuming you're, you know, in a newer compatibility land for iOS, and you have an async image, which does pretty much what those did. Here's my URL. Go retrieve it for me asynchronously, and when you're done, display it. And it is really cool that it does give you the power to have the different phases. So you can decide, you know, what you want to do when maybe this thing might take a while to load. All right, cool. Well, I can define some, you know, progress view or spinner or something. What happens when it's a failure? You know, sometimes you want to show something by default. And of course, when it's successful, what do you want to do? You've got hooks to choose. Like, well, we're maybe going to change the aspect ratio or, you know, put an Instagram filter on it or something, right? It's up to you. But
they're
it's kind of nice
this
to see this baked
in
the platform. Too easy. So let's go over that statement of like, why would we want it to be difficult?
You wouldn't want it to be difficult, but you know, it's kind of a rite of passage to get your app working the right way and working through those subtle little bugs because you missed one tiny little thing. Like the classic one was with the table view with the asynchronously loaded images and reusable cells, where mm-hmm. your old cell would be recycled before the asynchronous call came back, and suddenly the wrong image would show up in your cell. Right? Remember that classic bug that everyone had to figure that out at some point, but now nobody has to figure that stuff out anymore. It's too easy.
I think the rites of passages change over time, and you're right. You know, with difficult data source and async image, I'd have a hard time imagining what it'd be like to create a bug in this case.
Right.
But I don't know that I want to go as far as saying, you know, back in my day, occasionally our product list would show the wrong images and we liked it that way.
Right.
I was going to say, back in my day, you had to connect your data source and delegate to the table view controller instead of just dragging it out of the library and having it already connected.
It's true. Back in my day.
Yes, I remember back in my day, we had to, you know, actually count the number of references and, you know, remove them as we needed, as we popped them off.
Yeah.
I came in right at the tail end of that. So we said earlier that 2011 first iPhone for me was the iPhone 4S. They came on board during the summer. I think WWDC had already occurred, as I didn't, you know, attend or anything. But I was able to make use of the resources, and resources around that time had MRC, manual count stuff, and the newer stuff from WWDC had the ARC stuff. And so I always thought it was a little silly when I had these books, these physical paper books, mind you. They were like, so why do I have to do this retain thing and then this release thing? Like, it just seems like it's cluttering up my code. What does this do?
Well, you know, I will never argue that ARC was a bad thing. It was a huge step forward, huge positive thing. But it was the beginning, looking back at history, it was the beginning of the commoditization of iOS development that we've talked about on the show a lot. Before ARC, iOS development was kind of hard because you had to understand all that memory management, and it was easy to get it wrong. And you didn't really understand what you were doing, your app would be crashing constantly or have memory leaks for no end. And so a real sign of someone who actually kind of knew what they were doing was whether they understood the memory model. But with ARC, that kind of went away.
You know, it's funny. This pro tip for you if you ever get an interview with me, but one of the questions I ask young developers all the time is, how does memory management work in Swift? And a lot of them are like, ARC? And then like a pause. They don't even know what ARC stands for, you know, like, So it's you're right. It's a tricky thing, but, you know.
Well,
do you need to know it? I mean, that's the other issue. I mean, like the whole idea behind this async image is we all know, like, you could call for an image in a URL and it may not be there, or it may, you know, return, it may come back busted or something, or partial, you know. Like you said, we had to deal with that, those cases, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like, are we homogenizing and simplifying too much? Or are we doing it in such a way that you can go on to bigger problems, right?
Perhaps.
Yeah, that's the approach I take to it. So I want to see even more in this area. It's like, okay, so what we really need to just be dead simple so that anybody off, you know, off the street, to Mark's point, can do iOS development is like, I just want, you know, lists, basically old school table view stuff. I want lists that are smart about prefetching their content so it's ready when we want it. They're grabbing their resources asynchronously, but even further than that, being intelligent to realize, hey, you know what? The user just scrolled from the 0th item to the 100th item. We can go ahead and cancel or pause or delay in some other case. The, you know, 0 to 99. Let's go ahead and start fetching the 100th and the, you know, through the 110th element, or reprioritize them, or et cetera, so that we don't have to spend time, you know, tinkering with and messing around with that. And we can build the other parts of the app that we really want to do, you know, not the parts that's sort of, you know, necessary, but not sufficient to have a good quality app.
True.
But, you know, Mark, I think something you said there made me think about some of the early days of iOS development, where I think that you're quite right. People who really understood how manual reference counting worked were really the ones who created those high quality polished apps in the early days of the store. And they were pretty unique because I think by and large, most of those people had come from the Mac OS development world, right? So they had this enormous entrenched advantage over everybody else who was like stumbling to learn what's going on. Like, what the heck? What's this release thing?
It's kind of funny. They went from, just within a year, they went from being considered like the biggest outcast in the software development world, right? People who were still developing an Objective-C for the Mac were just really considered like out there and just old school and dinosaurs. within a space of a year, those people went from that to being super in demand and, you know, able to write an app that could make them $1 million overnight. Amazing.
Yeah. Speaking of making $1 million overnight, I mean,
no, that is a good segue. That's a good quality segue right there to our next article here. We'll have in the show notes for those of you driving at home. This is from App Figures. It is entitled "What's New in iOS 15 for App Store Optimization." And I think this is really good to show it. So Apple, I think, sort of breezed. Again, I've not watched the session myself, but at least in the keynote and the Platform State of the Union, I feel like they really breezed past this part, given how much content is here. So I appreciated seeing some of the options of like, okay, in-app events in search results, more stuff about search results, the App Store widget. Like, let's be honest, that's not a winner to me. I'm going right past that one. Custom product pages is one that really stuck out to me, that you can have up to 35 of these. So I think that's a very well-selected number, because when it comes to major sports leagues, you tend to have around 30 to 32 teams. So you could have like a Seattle Mariners or Seattle Kraken, themed app page, trying to invite local folks. And the A/B testing with product page optimization. I think these are the big winners for folks when it comes to this feature. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, no shade thrown on the folks who are, big enough to have like in-app events that people might actually really be serious about, thinking like Pokemon Go and stuff. But this is for the normal folks, right? The casual folks,
right?
Indie folks, yep, who are, pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps. Custom product pages and A/B testing. These are things you can actually do and probably see some benefit from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I think trying to get your app recognized on the App Store is a huge task, right? I mean, I don't know if it's still true, but like I'm sure when Mark was first publishing apps, you got an immediate spike on day one kind of deal, and then it kind of fizzled down to like nothing, and then it just kind of cruises along, right? And becomes pizza money, right? But yeah, I mean, A/B testing is something that, we've been doing on the web for millennia, it seems, having two different, and then trying to see, out of the two styles, which one seems to have more traction than the other, right? This is kind of an interesting thing. I'm curious about this widget thing that you skipped over, though, Jaime. Is that about getting featured, or is that something you can actually supply to Apple and then they'll pick it up, right? Get featured in the App Store, lots of visibility.
I mean, so there is a new App Store widget,
right,
that will show featured items. So I guess if you're fortunate enough to get featured.
Oh, are you saying, oh yeah, this is something that would appear on your desktop, on your iPad, or?
Yeah, which, I mean,
okay,
gotcha. I'm sure there's people who enjoy and this sort of thing. I personally will not go out of my way to say, hey, what if I had the, again, no shade towards the editorial folks over at Apple. They do some cool stuff when I go into the App Store from time to time, but I just don't know that I would have a widget to highlight this as part of my day.
You mean have it on your phone yourself? Like,
yeah, it's for other people, not me. I don't
install that many categories in, like, that you're interested in, like kid games or something like that. Like, that's the big challenge for us, is like finding something that's suitable for a 6-year-old kid, right?
I feel like the answer for that particular use case is plunking down the money for Apple Arcade and say, here, go try all of these. There's hundreds of them.
Well, no, there
isn't. Leave me alone if you've tried every single one of them.
Hang on. Whoa. Back up. Because I can tell you, I have Apple Arcade, and there is not a lot of apps for young children in Apple Arcade.
Oh, okay. So I stand corrected. I just assumed that was one of the big things for them, that it doesn't have to be the...
You would think, right?
Kill,
you would
kill think. Zone again, 457.
Well, see, I don't know what the criteria... I don't know what the criteria to get an app into App Arcade is about. I mean, like, I don't know... Have we talked about that before? I don't know. That what do you have to do to get your app into that sort of... that world, right? So I thought it was like almost like an elite club of people who have the inside edge on how to get in there, right? Or does a game have to be built in a certain way or have traction, right? Like some publishers I know that have been picked up and have arcade apps also have very successful games, for example, in the regular iOS app, right?
Yeah, I think it was more akin to the publisher studio kind of model, where I don't think you can submit your app necessarily to be included in Apple Arcade. I think it's more like, don't call us, we'll call you. Apple would notice you and say, hey, we sure would love for you to be in Arcade. Can you make this game exclusively for us, or can you take this existing game that has good ideas and just remove all the IAP and make it a part of Arcade? I think that's how it works. I don't
like. Well, I can tell you, like
could be, but
I can talk about this a bit too, and I think Mark can too. Is that like the whole idea of getting featured on the App Store? I've been featured on the App Store for a number of apps. Like one of Geek Squad was featured once. the Strombo app was featured once. Some of our Two Life ones were featured. And we used to talk to Apple here in Canada anyway about how to get featured. And they would say, you know, like they're always looking for people who are utilizing the latest, you know, frameworks and tools that they give us, right? So, you know, don't expect to get featured if your app hasn't been updated in 3 years, right, kind of thing. And you know, make sure you use all the new stuff that or try to use the new stuff that Apple introduces every year at WWDC and you know, the various events, right? You know, like, you know, we've had the large type thing. Now we have dark mode. Now we have accessibility, a big push on accessibility this year. Those are the kind of things that Apple's going to pay attention to, as well as, of course, you know, you've got a cool app. I mean, GeeSquad was featured in Canada for a while because it had a very Canadian sort of theme to it, right? I mean, it was kind of a janky app, but still Apple picked it up and somebody in the App Store saw it and, you know, decided to feature it, which was great, you know? But what, Mark, I know your music apps have been featured.
A number of my apps were featured, actually. In the early days, I have to say it was relatively easy to get featured because there wasn't as much out there and there was a lot of junk out there.
Right,
no offense to anyone who published something back then. But so in the early days, it seemed like if you had something that was a little bit niche and so a little bit out of the ordinary, and it was a quality, at least a decent app, there's a pretty good chance of getting featured in your category, which wasn't too hard. It was actually quite hard to get featured on a full App Store level. In other words, there was the front page of the App Store at the time. There was this one category of the real featured apps where Apple would come to you and get extra artwork and they'd feature you on the front page. That was quite difficult to do, but to be featured as a category actually was not that hard. So
right, yeah.
Yeah, so a bunch of my apps did that. I was only on the front page of the App Store once. That was with my Look Again app. And interestingly enough, I'm not sure whether it was chicken or the egg, but we got some really good press. Actually, that was how we met originally, Tim. Ironically, yeah, we had been putting out apps and had gotten, you know, some good features and some good, you know, good press just randomly. We would submit to review sites. So when it came out with this app, we kind of did a pre-meeting at Macworld with one of the more well-known bloggers at the time, app bloggers. And he liked the app, so he wrote about it before it was ever released. And then when it finally was released, we got a nice big bump, and Apple put us on the front page of the App Store, which was nice, which was fantastic. Like I said, I don't know whether it was just like Apple liked the app too, or were they reading the same blog? Probably they were just reading the same blog, and that's how they found out about it. But there was one thing that was actually extra nice was they had these every year. They'd have these different categories outside of the, you know, just the regular app categories. They would have like special lists of things, and they would have every year they'd have a best back to school apps. So for 3 years in a row, one of my apps on Scales and Modes, which was my music theory app, was featured as a best back to school app in the music category. That was nice for, you know, 3 years in a row. So even though it wasn't a new app by the third year, it was still in there. After the third year, it was kind of getting kind of long in the tooth, and so it never happened.
Yeah, but it had a unique style to it. I mean, because people weren't really talking about Scales and Modes that much, you know.
Right.
You know, now we've got Rick Beato on YouTube talking about it all the time, but you know.
Yep. So yeah, like I said, back then, if you were a little bit unusual, a little bit out of the ordinary, and a decent app, then yeah, you had a pretty good chance of getting featured in your category.
Yeah, like we did an app on about, so we had an app for couples, is what the gist of our first magazine app was, and so when Will and Kate, you know, Middleton got married, we got featured in the UK and in Canada. We couldn't crack the US App Store in terms of getting featured, but because there were apps, you know, covering the royal wedding at the time, but yeah, we like I said, we were on the news and stuff like that, and you know, I think, you know, I ironically, the day they came in to film us for CTV News here in Toronto about having built this app, I was asked to come into the studio and sit there and, you know, look like a developer and whatever, doing my thing. Ironically, at the moment when the cameras came through, the WWDC tickets went on sale. And so there, I was actually buying my ticket for WWDC while this was happening. So yeah, it's kind of funny. I was working as a developer, right? So
there you go.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Cool. Any more on that one there, Jaime?
No, I think that's good coverage.
We've nailed it. All right, cool. So let's move on to our picks.
Okay. So my pick is WWDC 21 lounges. So if you remember back at WWDC, they had these things called lounges, which were basically online chat areas where you could ask questions of Apple developers and hopefully get an answer. And they were really supposed to be kind of a transient thing. They were just kind of as it happened at WWDC. But a couple of enterprising folks, I guess, scraped all of the content while it was still up and have now put it up on GitHub. So it's still available to be perused at your leisure. And I haven't really dug in too deeply yet, but it looks like there's some interesting stuff here. There's a SwiftUI lounge QAs and an accessibility lounge QAs and a DevTools lounge QAs. So could be some interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, Leo was talking about, I think he attended or tried to attend the Playground one, because we were talking about the Xcode Playground? What was the thing we talked about? Oh, iPad Playground, where you could Swift Playground on the iPad. That's what it was, where you, in future you'll be able to code right on the iPad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Create apps and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the team was there that one. I think the night we were recording, Leo was talking about that.
Mm.
Cool.
So that's my pick.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that they didn't make that just part of the history. I can imagine there probably are reasons why to just, you know, this is dipping their toes in the water and limiting risk and etc. But, you know, nature finds a way and clearly has here where people thought about that and said, well, let me just, you know, sometimes this stuff is the best reference. Stuff from WWDC, even as the docs continue to improve and etc. But sometimes, like, look, I know they talked about this thing. Where was it? And like having non-ephemeral and also searchable ways of finding. Hey, I know they talked about something related to Swift UI. You know, right? Like when should I use this environment object or not? Oh, okay, there you go. I see the answer now. That's very helpful. I like this sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm just looking at my Slack app. Are the channels gone? Do you know?
I was under the impression that they were.
Yeah, they seem to be. It's funny, they seem to have just disappeared off my app. Oh, wait, no, here's one. WWDC21. Yeah, interesting. Just disappeared. That's app management on the fly. Cool. All right, so what do you got for us for a pick, Kami?
Yeah, mine is for people like me. So if you have only seen a handful, if that, of session videos from WWDC, and you're thinking, how should I even approach this now? I guess, you know, while you're live during the week of WWDC, it's kind of natural to watch per day, right? Here's Monday. Let's watch Monday's content. Whatever I feel is interesting. Tuesday, same thing. Thursday, you get the idea. But once the entire set of content is out there and available, it can be pretty overwhelming to say, oh, I don't know that I have time to watch all of them. What should I watch? And userloaf.com here has come up with this viewing guide, and very helpfully not only gives the links to things in nice categories like Swift, Swift UI, iPadOS, WatchOS, but also gives a little bit of explanation in my mind in some plain language of like, this is what this thing is, right? This is why you should care, which I think
Cole's notes, right?
What's that?
Or Cliff Notes, I guess. Cliff Notes.
Yeah, it's like, that's a good. Do people still use those anymore? Do they still sell those? This is pre-internet, kids. Back in my day, you couldn't just watch a 10-minute YouTube video to see, you know, what you should put in your book report. or watch the movie version of some, you know, Shakespeare play. No, you actually had to read the book or the play, or you'd go get the Cliff's Notes version that Barnes & Noble's or Borders or something, and it would give you the basic gist, right? The TLDR, too long, didn't read, quite literally. You know, what is this about? And I like this idea, Tim, the Cliff Notes version of what was the WWDC covered and handy links for if you said, oh, you know, I really do want to know what's this xCloud thing. Let me go take a look at this sets of views. And there's three of them. So easy to find.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to suggest we go through and look at our developer apps and see what videos we watched. But I ended up watching a ton of them and some that weren't on my book, like, you know, I'd watch a video and then, or I'd see something on Twitter about somebody would say something about, oh, you got to go check this one out, or even on this show. I mean, Mark mentioned a couple on the last episode. I went back and watched them again, right? So, like Doxy, I completely missed what Doxy was about until I went back and watched a few of the videos. That looks pretty cool. But yeah, like the one I was interested in was the Mac, building Mac fundamentals. I started working on it and I couldn't figure out why the code wouldn't compile. And then I realized, oh yeah, you need to have, you know, Monterey loaded up and you need to have iOS 13 loaded up because it's a Mac app, duh. So I did actually, I ended up putting Monterey on my Mac, but I haven't really gone back to it since I did that. But yeah, it's kind of cool because like, yeah, it says here, like, you know, two-part code long on building a Mac using SwiftUI makes it familiar ground for iOS developers, right? So That's the gist of what these two sessions are about. And it kind of, I think the developer app kind of explains what each one is as well. But yeah, this is sort of, and it's sort of clumped them into categories. If I'm not mistaken, I think the developer app does actually do them in groups too. Yeah, like down the side, there's like, they've got like essentials, and then they've prototyping, for instance, they've got in here. And they don't just include 2021, they also include 2019, 2018, 2017 as well. So kudos to the Mac developer app for that too. But yeah, this is a cool little cheat note thing here, for sure. How about you, Mark? Anything stand out that you, besides AppKit for
this site?
In general, WWDC in general.
Oh, well, we talked about this a lot already. So I haven't really done too much beyond what my watching in the first couple of weeks since then. But I definitely thought some of the iPad stuff was pretty cool, although there wasn't a huge amount of it. Obviously, the Swiftie and the Async Await stuff was pretty amazing. Looking forward to Xcode Cloud, although that could be a long time away. I suspect it will be a long time away for me. But don't have a lot of new input.
Yeah, I'm just looking through my list here on my list of bookmarks and the ones that I've watched. I said, I wonder if this is all everything I watched. Because I did watch a ton of them, but you know, it's kind of like you got to take a rest and come back to it later, right? Because unless you use it, you don't really. I find you can't really get into it too much. I watched a lot of the stuff on in later things, later shows. What was this 2020? I was looking at what's new in Objective-C. I'm like, what? That's from 2020. All right. Anywho, okay. So my pick. We were talking about Swift Package Manager at work today, and my friend Eric pointed out that he's been building some tools for us at work. Looking forward to using Swift Package Manager in our coding. And this is, I think, this site, and I've linked to the blog here, but the actual basic site, it reminds me a bit of CocoaPod's site, right? Because it's basically got a listing of recently added Swift packages, like open source Swift packages. Oh, here's Bonmo. I know the author of Bonmo. He spoke at NS North a few years ago. Like Markdown Kit is one, for example, or Google App Measurement is another one that's just recently been released. And it's basically a search engine. You can type in what you're looking for, and it'll show whether or not there's a Swift package that matches what you're looking for. And if you click on any one of them or find one, it tells you kind of sort of what it does. Like here, Bonmo. Bonmo was a pick on our show once, and beautiful, easily attributed strings in Swift is the description here. And then it shows, you know, below it, the compatibility with versions of Swift it works with, in this case, 5.4 or 5.3. It also works on iOS, macOS, ARM, and Intel, as well as tvOS. And then it shows the current version, and then also a description of what it does. And sort of is like sort of a... But like a README kind of style page where, you know, explains how to use it and that kind of stuff. So I just, like I said, this reminds me very much of the CocoaPods, main CocoaPods site. I don't know if you guys ever gone over there to look for something. But yeah, it gives you the link to the actual package and away you go. So it's kind of cool that you can search for stuff inside of Swift Package Manager as it becomes more, you know, I think Swift Package Manager has arrived. I don't know if you guys agree or not. What do you think?
Seems like it, yes. Apple's definitely pushing it with the integration into Xcode Cloud and Playgrounds. Yeah.
Cool. Comment, Tommy?
Yeah, I think it's similar to Swift and Swift UI and other things where there's just sort of that tipping point, right? And Apple really helps when it does things like, oh yeah, like you can use Swift Package Manager for the Swift Playgrounds on the Mac, but not like CocoaPods, right? So it's similar to, oh, you can, what was Swift UI only first? Whatever the first thing was, I don't even remember anymore because Swift UI just seems like it's just like a natural part of, yeah, you know, when you're doing stuff, you're going to want to do Swift UI. Certainly if you're going to build a totally brand new app, you don't have to worry about backwards compatibility. By the time you work through the details of what you want to do with your app, you know, we're coming up on September pretty soon here in just a couple months. So
yeah,
is it worth, you know, trying to go back to iOS 10 or some other nutty thing? Probably not. You know, I mean, if you got billions of users like a Instagram or a Facebook or Twitter, I mean, sure, right? Because the cost is different. But you know, I do think that things like this are helpful, especially as it all starts to come together, right? Like right now, you probably could find the thing you wanted, you know, in CocoaPods, not necessarily find it in Swift Package Manager. That's true. Becomes increasingly less true as time goes on, as more people start sort of seeing where the puck is going. right? And say, oh, should I do this new project or this updated version of a project in CocoaPods? Maybe not. I just switch over to Package Manager. We're going to make it available there. And then it just becomes this flywheel effect, right? Where now the next project is like, oh yeah, we should just do Swift Package Manager. Oh yeah, they're doing, we should, right? And it just goes on and on. So I think it's certainly come of age in terms of, it's not a silly side gig sort of thing anymore for folks. It's like, oh no, we're legitimately using this. This is a big part of how we're going to build apps.
Yeah, and I didn't talk about the fact that there, you can rate, like there are ratings here, like there's like BonBon's got like 3,600 stars, so I don't know what the scale of that is, but at least, you know, you've got 3,600 other people who've used this. But coming back to the back in my day kind of comment, I notice here that it says indexing over 3,800 packages, and which represents over 59,000 versions. I remember looking something up on the internet, and said, like, you know, there's like, I can't remember if it was like a million pages it was being indexed back in the 90s, you know, so I remember looking at the internet going, oh, look at all those pages there, and sunny. But, you know, now, of course, there's billions of pages, right? So it's kind of like, to mark this moment in time, this is June 30th, 2021, there are 3,800 packages listed on the Swift Package Index. So I have to keep that as a marker, right? 6 years from now, when we're talking about it, we can look back in this episode. Back in my day. Alrighty. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, how many people want to get in touch with you? Where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devofthehair.
All right, Mark, people can get in touch with you.
MarkR@snapsoft.com.
All right. And once again, my name is Tim Mitra. It still is Tim Mitra. Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
What I was saying, I think I've told you this sort of story before, but I have this situation on my Mac where it's one of these hub things with two USBs on the one side, and I leave my microphone and PA and everything plugged in, and my keyboard and my DisplayPort monitor and all that kind of stuff. So when I grab this and go over to the couch, I just quickly unplug it and go, right, and sit down. And when I come back, it rarely remembers my audio settings, right? So when I come back and I sit down and I turn on my USB mic, like just now, the master volume was like right down to nothing. And then the playback volume in my head was like turned up to like 11, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, what? So I often sit down at the computer and it's usually one speaker. This today it was both speakers in stereo, which is like new. So is that an improvement? I don't know. But yeah, it's just weird. Every time I sit down at the computer and plug my audio stuff in, I have to make sure I do it well in advance and check the audio settings. I think I talked about this before, right, that I have to go in and do like write an Apple script or something to have it just push a button and have it set up all the stuff. I'm sure this app is scriptable. This is one from Apple, right?
Push the button. Never mind. Obscure reference.
Push the button. Mm-hmm.
I didn't get it either, so you're okay, Tim.
We got galvanized, galvanized by the Chemical Brothers.
No, sorry.
You might, I'm aware of the Chemical Brothers. I don't know their songs too.
You might know it if you heard.
I might, probably, but the only Chemical Brothers I know off the top of my head is the theme from the Lost in Space movie that they made, the really bad one. I mean, you know, unless you're a Lost in Space fan like I am, and then they're all good, right? Anyway, so how you been?
Good.
Both of you, either one.
Okay.
Okay.
How's the temperature there, Jaime?
It is nicer. It is down in the 70s today, which is good because over the weekend and Monday being the worst part of this week was in the hundreds. Just unusual here. I think it was record breaking.
Yeah. We had some high 90s. I don't think it ever broke 100 here, but it was, high 90s. Pretty nasty.
So it kind of broke records in Vancouver. Like they're talking about a Canadian heat dome or something like that. Is that the kind of craziness? Like it was 40 something, 44, which Celsius, which is like, I don't know, $50 Canadian or American. Let's get the PCALP app out and figure this out.
111 Fahrenheit if it was 44 Celsius.
Wow. That's hot.
Yeah. What did you have in Seattle, though? Because, I mean, you're not that far, right?
I don't recall what the actual value was. I think it was around 109, 110. I don't know. I'd have to look to see what the record was. But the whole heat dome you're talking about hit the entire Pacific Northwest from Vancouver in British Columbia through Seattle down to Portland, Oregon. Everybody was suffering.
Yeah, I didn't think it was an exclusive thing, but yeah.
And it's not.
I mean, but it's hard to tell. No, not at all. It was
humid,
50-some percent humidity, dew point probably in the 60s.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
Do you have AC at your house?
We don't have AC. I don't even really have good space for like a little unit. So we're mostly dealing with other methods. Our area was okay. We've got some trees around us, so it helped.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's concrete jungle areas that people were definitely suffering real hard. They had the libraries kept open for extended hours so people could be there, be cool in the air conditioner. There were cooling places that had opened up. It's like just like big warehouses with air conditioner. And it's kind of a full community job to keep people doing okay.
Can you imagine if it was last year when we were still in full lockdown? That would have been awful.
Yeah, because at least people could get out and go to places. Like, you know, we have very cold waters here, so going to the beach is helpful in that case.
Mm-hmm.
Still dangerous because your body gets shocked going from, you know, like 100 to 45 degrees, but at least it's plausible to do something about it.
Yeah, bookmarks.
So I'm curious about one thing, because I had seen some Canadians say that Canadian houses, to no one's surprise, are built to contain heat at all costs, right? Which sort of makes sense, because it's cold.
It depends on where you live, right? Like, Vancouver's not quite that way, but Vancouver's a lot of wood construction, whereas Ontario, Quebec, and places like that are, they were generally made of brick and stone and, you know, insulated and whatever.
Yeah, but I'm guessing, doesn't the insulation work both ways, though? Like, if you can get your house cool, which is maybe the biggest problem, if you can get it cool, won't it tend to stay cool because of that insulation?
Yes. Okay. I mean, that said, I mean, I live in a house that's 100 and more than 110 years old. Yeah, let's say 110 for argument's sake. And it's surprisingly not insulated, considering, like, you know, it's like it's a couple of layers of brick, which are not really that thermally, you know, we have R ratings. I don't know if you guys use those in the States, but, and then, you know, like plaster and lath, which again is like not really heavily insulated, right? So as we retrofit these houses, we put in lots of, you know, fiberglass or mineral wool insulation and, you know, vapor barrier to them to keep the moisture in and all that kind of stuff, right? So, yeah, I mean, so as we've gone through, like the house I live in now, we only have windows on the east and west side. Not because I'm, you know, a very thin, long house, and so when it gets cold, it tends to stay cold. When it gets hot, it tends to stay hot, right? So, you know, but yeah, I mean, the whole trick to air conditioning in our environment, probably in Mark's too, is the first thing you have to do is cool the room, and then it starts to feel cool, right? So you can't like just turn on air conditioning and have it and cool your house. And the same thing with heat. I think you have to sort of heat the wood and the surfaces and whatever to be able to return forced air heat seems to feel better than air conditioning does when it first kicks in. Like, I can tell you right now, our house is like, we're like 50-60% humidity in the house, even though we've been running air conditioning for the last, you know, 3-4 days, right? But yeah, what's it like in where you are, Mark? You obviously have air conditioning, right?
Yeah, I've got air conditioning, although, you know, when it's 100 degrees, it kind of can't keep up, unfortunately. It's not that good. Maybe I just need to get it get the coolant recharge or something like that. But we had a few hot days that were, like I said, high 90s that were kind of nasty and humid. But it's cooled off quite a bit. It's probably been in the 70s this week. It's not bad.
Yeah. We've been up and down. I mean, like, it's supposed to go down to 17 degrees tonight, like, which is relatively cool compared to, you know, that's like a cool night in San Francisco kind of thing, right? So it's like 19 degrees Celsius is sort of is what California or San Francisco usually is, like 68, 70 degrees, I guess, you know?
Well, San Francisco is usually a little bit colder than that. everywhere else outside of San Francisco is like that.
Yeah. Well, I know, like, Sacramento, it's like blazing hot stuff.
Yeah,
like that,
but, yeah. San Jose gets kind of hot too, because we're kind of in a valley. You know, where there's mountains between us and the ocean, and then there's another set of mountains on the inside of the bay, and so, you know, the heat gets trapped in between the mountains. It can get pretty hot here.
Yeah, just using pCalc here to calculate the temperature. 90 degrees is 66 Fahrenheit, so roughly give or take a degree point or whatever. Mm-hmm. There we go, another one in the can. Hopefully it all recorded properly and everything too. So it's interesting, I could hear some crackling in during the show. Remember I said sometimes I hear static in my own recording. I wonder if that was what I was hearing.
And what, so
I've found that is usually caused on Zoom when you do something very memory intensive, like running the simulator.
Yeah,
it causes
we talked about that Core Audio demon bug, right?
Yeah, I never tried that as a fix. Did you ever try it? Did it work?
Yeah, definitely. Well, so sometimes when I'm listening to audio like YouTube or whatever, or watching a WWC video, it'll actually be very crackly audio. Mm. So yeah, I've gone in and forced that to quit, because it does seem to be running. But you're right, I quit just before the show. Oh, simulator is running. Damn it! Whoops. Well, that's going to be fun to edit. Yeah, I've had that before. Let me see. Let's activity viewers, how we found it. Right, I quit. Like I said, I quit Xcode. I just assumed, I guess, that simulator would quit as well. Oh well, Core Audio. Oh, look at all the Core Audio demons running. Crap. Wow, that's a lot of them. Yeah, 53 hours on my oh man, oh well. That was fun. Yeah, 53 hours of CPU time has been running. Crazy. Oh, wait, just quit, but it didn't quit the app, it quit the activity viewer. All the more reason to hate stupid Core Audio thing. Core Audio D, how do I get you to quit? Double click you. Yeah, wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you hear us?
Are you guys on Big Sur? Are you on Big Sur? I would hope I am. Yeah.
I believe I am. I don't think I'm on the latest.
So I've been having a thing on Big Sur where the Finder will crash.
Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so other apps continue running, but the Finder itself crashes, and there's nothing you can do except restart your machine.
Really? Oh, I've not had that before. I've had it.
So anytime you click on the Finder, you get a beach ball.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You try to go to force quit, you get a beach ball.
Really?
Because it's part of the Finder.
Huh.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, I've had more problems with Big Sur than I've ever had with a Mac OS ever.
Are you on your M1 or
on the M1? Really? Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you don't have any choice, do you?
Nope.
Huh. I've had Finder crashes and stuff like that, you know, for a while too as well.
Yeah. Hmm. I was having that problem where the mouse would just stop responding to clicks.
Yeah.
Right. Same. Yeah. I have problems where I can never just restart my machine because it just hangs and I have to physically use the button, power down button, to restart it pretty much every time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's bad.
You know, I haven't had those issues, but I'm also still running on an Intel. You're running on the...
Yeah, although I have...
The M1.
Online, right? I've seen people reporting the same issues on Intel machines. So I don't know. It may be hardware dependent.
I wonder what the combination hardware, is that causes it to...
some app I'm running or something. It's annoying.
Hmm. A handheld that runs Big Sur. You're looking at your link here. I mean, friends of the show. You puppy. Oh, look at that little guy. Is that a Rottweiler, I guess? Cool. What else is new and exciting?
Are we still recording?
We can stop.
I got nothing specific.
We don't have to.
We are still recording.
Yeah.
We can say goodbye. Say goodbye. Bye.
Okay, bye.
All right.
Are we not? Okay. Bye.
I wonder if Zoom stopped recording when I did that. Stop recording. Okay. Then quick time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.